Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
So, welcome to our first episode of 2024 of the Science of Sport podcast. Thank you for putting up with us over the last couple of weeks as we take a bit of a break over the festive season. And a big thank you to Joanne Murphy, who is doing our voiceover, our intro, and some of our links in our podcast as we revitalize our look and feel, and with a different artwork on our features, and also don't forget also our little intros as well. So thank you very much to her, and you'll hear her doing our intros for the next couple of years, I reckon, as we get into season six of the Science of Sport podcast. Can you believe it? Season number six. Thank you to all of you who've been supporting us over this time, particularly those of you on Patreon. And don't forget, you can also, if you're not a member of our Patreon support base, you can get on to patreon.com and look for Science of Sport podcast, and for the price of a coffee, you can be a supporter of ours and get some exclusive content, newsletters, all that sort of thing. Right, so to kick things off in 2024, let's catch up with some of the news that's been happening in the world of sports science, and there certainly has been some interesting stuff. Not least of all was a world record in the world 10-kilometer by a woman by the name of Agnes Ingetic. How do you say it? Ingetic. 28:46, but I mean, that wasn't the real story. I mean, in fact, she was incredibly fast over the 5K as well, wasn't she? Amazing.
Yeah, these world records are interesting because they're not all that interesting maybe anymore, would you say? I don't know.
Like, yeah, I mean, I actually missed it, to be honest, because it does seem to happen every single week.
Like, world records used to be generational achievements that made you say, what a breakthrough. And then, okay, we learn a little bit more, and then we started to get cynical and skeptical about world records. I think a lot of people are now disillusioned by them because they're so frequent as to be almost, I'm not going to say meaningless, because obviously they have meaning. I just don't know if it's the same meaning we're accustomed to them having. So Ingetic goes and runs a world record by a lot, like 20 something seconds faster than the previous. Equals a world record on the way to a world record. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So, and then you compare that to what the 10K track time is, and she's...
It's faster than that.
Yeah. I mean, it's,
and there might be reasons for that. And the 5K time, she runs 14:13 through 5 on the roads. The track world record's 14:01. The time she runs at 10 on the world athletic scoring tables is equivalent to a 13:50-odd, I think I read in the analysis that I saw. So
13:43.
Yeah, that's it. So that tells you that track world record is due to go. Remember, that fell this year. And Faith Kipyegon, I think, has got it. But Gide is close to 14. There's probably a handful of women who could go under 14 in 2024. Well, and a few years ago, it was 14:10. 14:12 was the barrier. So it shows you where we are.
Yeah. I mean, sub-15 a few years ago was an outstandingly good 5K time on the track.
Yeah, these days, if you're only sub-15, you're not even getting invited to like the second-tier global meetings, never mind the Diamond Leagues. You have to be 14:30 or faster to look in there.
Yeah.
So it's like this is where we are, you know. It's just these times have a different meaning to what they used to have. And I made the point in response to Tim Hutchings, who's the commentator, does the Diamond League. He complains regularly about the lack of regulation of the shoes has created this situation. He's not alone. We've done that on this podcast. We've done three or four times, bemoaned the failure to see this coming and devaluing performances. And there clearly needs to be some line drawn where they say pre and post, you know, BCAD vibes. Because that's part of it. But for me now, the bigger problem is that 15, 20 years ago, when a world record in running got broken, there was skepticism about doping.
Yeah.
And if a performance improvement was too good to be true, we had a within relative construct now, a reasonable confidence to doubt it because of doping. Now we don't, because there are two moving parts that are so important to the time, doping and technology, that it's really hard to know what we're looking at. That's what I find the shoes doing the most damage to is our ability to interpret. You know, like, okay, you had to be cynical 15, 20 years ago because you know there was EPO in the sport and what was happening. But like you could frame your cynicism.
Yeah.
Am I making sense, you know? Like, does it?
No, absolutely.
No. And that's why, like, then what happened in response to Tim Hutchins' tweets was people kicked off and said, Tim, you're missing the obvious. It's got to be doping only. Well, no, it's got to be the shoes, and potentially the doping thing hasn't gone away. But I think the shoe is like the shiny new disco ball that is distracting people from the possibility that there may also still be doping.
Yeah.
But it's clearly not a zero benefit thing. But then neither is doping zero. So now we've got, I don't know, there's two. It's like, I would use the analogy, and I did on Twitter. It's like if you make a stew and you want each of the flavors to come out, but then you put so much salt and so much something else in there that in the end, nobody knows what else is in it.
Yeah.
That's where performance is now. No one else knows how it's made because two flavors are overpowering the taste.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting, I mean, and because there's not a lot of research around this, is that how the shoe technology, I mean, every year there's a new model of these super shoes that comes out. And to what extent are they getting better and better at improving performances? And where is potentially the plateau, if there will ever be one? Will there always be shoe development that will improve times? Because at this level of Agnes, she could be running in a new shoe next year that will give her another 1%, therefore she could break the record again and again.
By another 15 seconds. Yeah, and it's not her. And that's the point, I guess, right? Like, world records were meant to be a leap forward for human physiology and our ability to train and develop that physiology. Now it's the same human physiology with the same development and optimization, but just running faster because of like ground human interaction via the shoe. That's exactly the problem, I think. Because when the first Vaporfly was introduced and there was that research, it was still a complex problem because remember it showed a 4.2% reduction in oxygen cost, and then you have to extrapolate, what does that actually mean for performance? Well, that depends on how fast you're going. It depends on how you responded to the shoe. That's a whole other thing. Is Ngetich like the women's marathon world record from last year? Is she just a magnificent responder to a shoe, and she's trying out different types, different models, and she's getting that benefit? I don't know. But the point is, when there was only one, it was a complex problem, but a simpler complex problem. Now you've got the complex problem made more complex by evolution and development in tech and individual response versus non-response. And meanwhile, there's two elephants in the room, and everyone's looking at one, and maybe the other one's there, but then everyone else is saying, forget this one, look at that one. It's a mess. The running is a mess.
Yeah, I agree. You touched on it very briefly there, but I always wonder, I wonder if there's anybody looking at this research. When you talk about responders and non-responders, what makes a responder versus a non-responder? In other words, is it leg length? Is it the size of the foot? Yeah. Is it the flexibility of the Achilles?
The way you strike, forefoot like versus all sorts heel.
Of things. I'd be fascinated to know, like, if you look at all these records that we've seen over the last couple of years, which type of athlete, if there is one, has been the one to be the best? Is there a similarity in terms of their physiology that have allowed them to take advantage of the technology? In other words, do shorter runners take it more less advantage or more advantage on these shoes? It would be interesting to see that, because it could be dependent on physiology.
Actually, I agree. Like, people who have a high loading rate maybe get like 1% more return, and that's the difference.
Yeah.
But we do know that the range in responders versus non-responders is huge.
Mm.
We discussed last year on the pod, I think, a couple of studies that came out, and I'll find the links and put them in the show notes, where you could try 8 different shoes and your best to your worst was 5 or 6%.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's minutes in a marathon.
Yeah, this level, that's a lot.
It's huge, right? Like, so, and I said at the time, what this means is that you could basically, if you gave 10 athletes random access to a bucket of shoes and they had to pick blindfolded and run the same race 10 different times, you could see a completely different result on account of nothing more than shoe response. So that's how it is. So if I was an athlete, and athletes have done this, I would very seriously go and test 5 or 6 different shoes in lab settings and see which one I benefit the most from, and then hope like hell it's my sponsor's one.
Yeah.
Because if it's not, then I have to try and ask my sponsor to make a I've got to try and ask that company to make a blank unbranded shoe and then stick sponsor logos on it, which has been done.
Which has been done, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was been done 20 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. That's where we are. And then I think that, so I agree with you. I think the responder, non-responder thing is really interesting, really complex though, because there are so many moving parts in biomechanics that will affect that. And then the other interesting thing I think is how it's changed training. Because if an athlete has access to this shoe and they can afford an expensive shoe with a short lifespan, so that we're talking elites now. But what, you know, when you think about a marathon runner, even a 10K runner who's probably doing 150 to 180K a week regularly, the biggest limiting factor is damage.
Yeah.
The one thing that constrains you from doing that 5% more quality work, 10% more volume. And if these shoes are, as is purported, reducing the degree of damage, then the training ceiling has gone up, and that would be interesting to explore.
And many of those elite athletes do say that they're able to train more. There's definite evidence.
I remember like right just before lockdown, there was a conference in which research was presented in ultra trail runners where muscle soreness and perceived exertion was lower in these shoes than in regular running shoes. And that's ultra runners, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, you would imagine that it might shift the proportion of intensity, might increase the overall volume of training with the same proportion of intensity, but either way you're still going to get benefit. So that would be really interesting to know about. So yeah, I don't agree with people who say that the shoes are not the factor anymore. I don't know if they are, and I don't know how much they're the factor, but they clearly are non-zero factors. They are something.
Yeah.
And then of course you have, it's Kenya, it's East Africa, where we know that we know it because so many athletes get done for doping. Like I couldn't even tell you the last 3 or 4 because I see it and I just gloss over it. I say, oh, another one. You know, in the last few weeks, there have been 2 or 3 at least that I can think of.
Mm.
It must be approaching 100 in the last 5 years, all from Kenya.
Which is an epidemic.
Yeah. So even though Ngetic herself hasn't, you know, okay, never failed a test. Now I sound like Lance Armstrong. But Ngetic herself, I can't think, I've not seen direct links to dopers, training squads, coaches, and so on. But, I mean, you just are by association questionable.
Mm.
It's just the reality of it.
An interesting thing that you mentioned at the start of that was the fact that, obviously, this road time has outstripped the track time. But there is a difference in the rules regarding the kind of shoes that you wear. So could that be a factor in the fact that you actually have more of a technological advantage on the road with different heel heights?
It could well be because, okay, so back to basics here. Listeners may remember the road shoe was the first one, was that marathon running Vaporfly.
Yeah.
And the key issue there was it's the foam and the carbon fiber plate interaction. The carbon fiber plate had been tried before, but it didn't work because it was flat. So it turns out that probably to get the benefit from carbon fiber, you need it to be curved. And there were technical things. A guy called Darren Stephenson had done some work showing many years ago that if you put a carbon fiber plate, you increased the work that was required at the ankle joint. And so that might have made the cost higher. And so whatever cost reduction you got was offset by that loss,
right?
Or that increase in demand. The curvature seems to get rid of that. So it's an essential component of these shoes is that they're curved. But the only way you can curve it is to build the back of the shoe up so that you can create what basically imagine like a soup ladle. That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
And so the first shoes that came out had this like huge what's called stack height to enable. It's a scaffold basically that allowed thick foam, high elastic energy return, but stabilized by this carbon fiber plate. And sure enough, that tech made its way into the track. The World Athletics Authority's response to shoes was to limit that stack height, but they limited it differently on the road than they did on the track. So on the road, you can have a bigger stack height than you can in a track spike.
Yeah.
And so if the stack height and the degree to which you curve that carbon fiber is the factor, then it does make sense that there's a potentially 1%, 0.5%, whatever it is, greater benefit in a road shoe than a track spike. Now, what'll be interesting to see is whether You see, so they can't. And in fact, I remember at the time, athletes were running track races in the road shoe because they knew that it was going to benefit them. They can't anymore.
Yeah.
So it may well be that within the next 3 years, all the road records outstrip the track records, which had never happened before.
I was going to say, just to put that into context, normally the track will be faster than the road.
Yeah.
Purely because it's, you know, you're not going through any corners.
It's flat and the Titan gives you greater energy return than the tarmac does. Mm. But now even what the tracks give can't match what the shoes provided would appear. Mm. So that element alone tells you that the shoes are not nothing.
Yeah.
Like some people are wanting to dismiss them.
It'd be interesting to see what she could do on the track over the same distance wearing the track shoes. Then you could actually do a relatively simple experiment to say, well, she's actually the lowest stack height actually is the difference by X amount.
There was some confusion, which is again typical of what's been created in the space, about what shoe she was in. She was in Adidas Takumi Sen 9, which has got a heel thickness of 33 mil. Now, the limit in the track is 25. So she's a good 25% too big at the back for a track shoe. But on the road, no problem. And then with that, what Adidas have got is not a full carbon fiber plate, but it's really just semantics, because what they've done is they've just split the plate into five, like, fingers almost.
Yeah.
And so they're almost trying to mimic the metatarsals of the foot. So they call them energy rods. But it's the same concept. It's a carbon, it's a stabilizing carbon fiber plate. The fact that they're rods or plate for me is it's just semantics.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she is benefiting from shoe tech. That shoe tech may well be improving. Maybe they're changing the stiffness, changing the curvature. Who knows? But the problem is you get these records and they kick off this furious debate and no one is actually celebrating human evolution, advancement.
Mm. I mean, we ran a story 2 years ago now in Runner's World talking about the shoe wars.
Mm.
And it actually has become a bit like that. That's what it feels like. It's like 1 week Adidas break a record, and then a couple of weeks later Nike do it. And they're almost trying to out-market each other as to who's got the fastest shoe.
Mm.
And it's becoming less about the athlete and more about the technology, which is kind of what we've
exactly.
said.
Exactly.
But it is an interesting thing to see, because there's those two brands in particular are the ones that seem to be facing off against each other every second. Although I think Adidas has probably got the edge now in terms of records.
They may well have now,
But and remember, Nike, this is Nike the same, always led the way.
It's the same pattern we saw in swimming in 2007, 8, 9, where Speedo came out with that LZR laser racing suit, and then Arena had to imitate. And there were a few others, the swimsuits that you'd never heard of, but they joined the war and made really fast swimsuits. And then all of a sudden, FINA at the time, they were called, now World Aquatic, said, no, this is enough. We're going to say knees to waist for men and knees to shoulders for women, and that's it. And I think it does. I mean, it constrains the commercial landscape, but it ensures the integrity of the world records at least a little bit, or at least the meaning.
Mm.
Maybe, anyway, it's too late for that. This is the new normal.
It's not, I was going to say, it's not going to change anything. Mm. I mean, we've got, you know, in sports science terms, we can talk about BC, before carbon and after carbon.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Talking about performance, in cycling, there's been a lot of discussion on the various platforms around the rule now by the UCI, who've now banned these.
It'll be 2025.
That's right, yeah. Mm. So they're banning these interned brake hood levers. And for anybody that's watched Tadej Pogacar, you would have seen him riding with these almost turned in brake hoods. And so there's a bit of a debate about the fact that these are turned in off normal handlebars, but there's also this discussion about how if you're riding bars that are slightly flared, that gives you a natural intern of the bar, and therefore you have this natural intern. So it looks like they're going to keep the gravel flared bars that will still be legal, which means we might see more flared bars in road cycling. But the banned version is when you're turning those levers in, not in line with the flare of the bar.
Yeah,
I don't know whether I'm explaining this properly. But
I suppose if you're not watching much cycling and it's not your sport, you might say, "What are you talking about?"
Yes.
But basically, if you're standing dead in front of a guy coming towards you on a bike, the brake hoods, which are those guys at the top to sort of house the brake levers, and the drops, which is the curvature, I think buffalo horns, those are pretty much on the same plane. You know, they're in line with one another. Now, 4 years ago, a trend was present in cycling where when a cyclist was off the front and trying to get away from the peloton, they would try and adopt as aerodynamic a position as possible. And that typically involved putting their forearms on the handlebars and then getting into what looks like a time trial position. but now your hands are holding nothing. And they used to call this puppy paws, because effectively you got like your parallel forearms and your hands are just sort of dangling off the front of the bike.
Unbelievably dangerous.
If something happens and you got to brake, you've got to get out of that position, get your hands onto the hood, then brake. You can see why this is a problem.
Or if you hit a bump in the road.
Yeah, because you got no like physical control over the bike other than maneuvering it with your forearms. So they said, understandably, that's not going to be allowed. You've got to have your hands in contact with the bike. So I think you create a problem and people will solve it. And so the solution was, well, then we'll turn the hoods in so far that we can basically be in that position and still have our hands on the hoods of the bike. And that got extreme. So you make really narrow handlebars with in-turned brake hoods. So you angle them inwards and you can basically get into the time trial position on a road bike.
Mm.
Now, where this I think is interesting, and I don't disagree that they needed to do something about it, is that I was listening to a podcast in which they interviewed Ben Healy's coach. It's called The Performance Process by the Escape Collective guys. And he was saying he was frustrated with it because, in his opinion, the in-turn brake levers weren't dangerous. Narrow handlebars weren't more dangerous. The handling was fine. The braking was fine. So now he has reason to say that because his guy, who was so successful last year, Ben Healy, has got quite narrow. I think he said 33 centimeters, which is like, I mean, I couldn't get into that. I'd feel like I was wearing a corset.
You can visibly see him when he's riding. He looks very
really, really
crunched
narrow.
In, yeah.
But he's a tiny guy, right? So, maybe it's proportional to his shoulder width, and he can get away with it.
Mm.
Says the handling is not a problem. Fine. Access to the brakes is not a problem. The guy interviewing him on the process is Ronan McLaughlin, who's the Everesting world record holder, incidentally. He says when he turned his in, he did find that it was more awkward to brake, and he didn't have the braking power and the braking reaction time and speed. So, okay, so it's one guy saying one thing, one another. To me, what's interesting again about this is that the UCI have made this change based on what from the outside appears to be a collection of objections, anecdotal, you know, because it would actually be quite easy to test whether in-turn brake hoods do compromise braking performance. You could just ask 50 sub-elite guys to go along a flat road at 40k an hour with a car behind them, and then when the siren goes off, brake and measure how long it takes them to slow down to 10, for instance. It wouldn't be that difficult to do. Now, what you do with that is trickier, but still, the point is that in where I'm working with World Rugby, we are quite committed to publishing evidence that informs law change for the benefits of welfare. I don't see the UCI doing that. I read a piece on Bike Radar where Mick Rogers, who's head of UCI Innovations, talks about they've got evidence that turning the brake levers in puts more stress and strain on the handlebars and can cause them to brake. Okay, cool. So there's obviously some evidence. I like the idea of like having these things out there for people to look at and evaluate, explain your reasoning kind of thing. And UCI never seemed to do that. We spoke before when Gino Maeder died in the Tour of Switzerland last year, very tragically. Like UCI, I don't know that they have a real understanding about what the risk factors are for causing accidents. Are there more accidents because of in-turn brake hoods? Yes or no? If yes, and you know that that's the factor that caused it, then you obviously have to ban it. But is it true, or is it just a feeling? Is you basing your decisions on evidence, or is it emotion? I don't know.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing, and this is just a feeling I get from the UCI, traditionally the UCI have tried to keep cycling, in other words, they don't necessarily embrace a lot of change, because I think one of the real strengths of cycling is that there is a reasonably level playing field. So, you know, look at the design of the bikes. Bikes are relatively the same design. You can't
When you watch Vinegar beat Pogacar, you don't go, if only Pogacar was on a Cervelo.
Yes. And largely you could say that the top riders in the world are riding bikes that are equally
in terms of
performance. Once you start playing around with in-turn brake levers and, you know, Superman positions like they banned before, he's suddenly starting to mess with the ethos of what cycling is really about. So I kind of support it because I believe that you actually, once you start allowing that, how far do you let it go? And even though there might be evidence to and for and against it, essentially it's changing the design of the bike, which is not what the UCI are known to let go very easily.
I don't disagree. And I do think my feeling is on this, and I've never, look, to be clear. I've never swung the brake levers in by 30 degrees and said, let me see how this goes. And I don't think I ever will.
No.
I'm not very good, as you know, keeping the bike upright, even with my current brake levers in the old-fashioned positions. But I agree with you. And the problem, I suppose, that will create is that when you try and constrain, like what you said is like, at what point does it stop? Like, how far does it go? In that landscape, everything you do will seem arbitrary.
Yeah.
Because someone will always be pushing up against the line that you've drawn. And they said, well, why is this line there? Why couldn't we go a little bit further? And like, actually, you have to make some kind of call.
You do.
And you'll never be able to precisely justify why it's X, not Y. So therefore, you just set it at Z and you say, like, let's get on with it now. Let's, you know.
It just equalizes everything.
Yeah. So yeah. I do understand that as a rationale. But it was interesting in the discussion, there was all this talk about it's definitely more dangerous. It contributes to more accidents. But these are bold assertions. There's just no evidence for them. So it would be nice for that process and that conversation to be a little bit more transparent and informed by evidence. Because even if there was no evidence for danger, I think you could still regulate it on the basis of what you've just said.
Yeah. Just making a level playing field and establishing a line in the sand, absolutely.
Exactly. This is interesting, though, to see how you say no puppy paws, then, okay, you've created a problem, here's the solution. Okay, that solution's not allowed. Interesting to know what's next. And this article on Bike Radar talks about the flared bars will now be the next thing, because that allows you to get the brake levers narrower, closer together, and at an angle without being at an angle, almost, in a way. And so I know you've set your road bike up in that way, and I'm going to get the same on my gravel bike as the flares, and I'm interested to see how I feel on them.
Yeah, because I think that's what the difference are in terms of performance is an interesting one. But for us as sort of lifestyle riders, putting the flared bars on my road bike has meant two things. First of all, it's more comfortable, particularly in the drops. So for those of you that ride bikes, you'll understand that normally the drops on your road bike are a lot lower. So if
you need reach, you need reach.
Whatever wear is on the flared bar, they tend to be shallower drops. In other words, you're sitting a bit more upright. So you tend to be in the drops more than you would normally be. But they are a bit narrow on the hoods. So that can feel a bit restrictive when you initially get on them. But they are more comfortable. And because they're angled in, there is an element of comfort there that is obvious. But I think based on that and looking at some of the sort of words that are coming from UCI and the experts, I think we're going to see flared bars as part of the Pro Peloton going forward. How far that flare is and what is good aero-wise and performance-wise, I think will be up for debate.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. And I think we're going to see more of that because there's so many road bikes and so many frames now that you can get where the flare is, you know, 2 or 3 degrees. You can get 11, 12 degrees on some of these adventure bikes.
So I've seen that the Trek's got a 3 centimeter difference. Yeah. So that whatever that angle is creates 3 centimeters greater width at the drops than at the hoods. Mm. So you can get away with narrower hoods, which is in theory more aerodynamic. I saw some stats. It works out to, and this is a tiny difference, but I suppose meaningful for some people. It's about a second every 3 kilometers.
Yeah. That's top level.
That's the performance benefit. Now, that's 10 seconds and a 30K time trial.
Mm.
Okay, they're not riding time trials on these bikes, but you get the idea. But yeah, the comfort thing is, and that's why I'm keen to get mine. I'm looking forward to seeing what that feels like.
Because I think it's the traditionalist in me, and I was discussing the cricket the other day with somebody talking about the modern T20 game, and I think the same, I have this attitude towards cricket being more traditionalist in terms of the game. So it's the same thing in cycling. Once you start, I don't think, for instance, you should have specific time trial bikes, because I think then it's the technology that starts to weigh up on the performance. Whereas in the old days, when you saw before Greg LeMond put aero bars in his bike in 1989, you know, everybody was riding their road bikes in a time trial.
Mm-hmm. And even the skin suits, actually.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the helmets.
Those all make a big difference.
Mm.
See, you can't necessarily change that, but you know, if you take it right back to the genesis.
You could say that road helmets must be used in time trials.
Yeah.
No reason you couldn't do that.
Yeah. Why must they use these bubble helmets?
In fact, that, as I understand, that is a conversation that is on the table. You might recall, remember Stefan Kung crashed in, I think it was European Time Trial Championships, where he basically just rode straight into a barrier.
Oh, that's right. Yes,
no, that one. And he crossed the finish line, and there was that debate about how brave this was, but it was actually just like really foolish looking. because he was absolutely hammered by this thing. He cuts all over his head, maybe concussed. Helmet was cracked. It was not a good look at all. He actually has said himself that he thinks the position you're in a time trial now is quite a dangerous one. You can only see 3 or 4 meters ahead of you at 55 km/h. That's
Chris Froome's even said that, isn't he?
I've seen discussion that the aero bars might be banned. I'd be very surprised if they went that far, but maybe they will.
Yeah,
maybe we do go back to road bike setups in time trials. I'd have no objection at all. I also want to see the best guy win, not the best equipment.
Then
you get the big budget teams, you know, that can afford to do the most wind tunnel testing and the most adjustments and the most sophisticated equipment have a 20-second advantage in a 30K time trial. That's not why I want to watch cycling.
And that can be the difference between whoever wins the GC.
It can be.
Based on that. And then you suddenly, you know, and even if you trickle that down to the lower levels, you know, if you're looking at sort of junior level at even in South Africa, there will be juniors who will have a top of the range time trial bike competing against juniors who can't do that. Therefore, they win the South African Championships because they have the better equipment. Mm. And again, it takes away from the essence of what cycling is really about.
Yeah, and again, it's like you look at track cycling. Track cycling is a place for that to happen.
Yeah.
That kind of innovation. But I've seen some people...
track cycling is more pure than the road cycling. I mean, track bikes are basic. And in terms of your sprint events, except for instance your pursuits and those sort of events.
I remember Ganna's 1 hour world record now is on a 3D printed bike that costs mid $6-figure, right?
Yeah, but I'm talking more specifically about racing. So the short sprint events tend to be the same bikes and the Kieran and those sort of events.
I heard one director of an Olympic Federation's track cycling program say track cycling is just science on wheels. As long as you have the best scientific testing and equipment, you'll win. Because the difference made by, and this is for 4K pursuits and 1K, the time trial and stuff like that. As long as you got the best equipment, like the difference between humans, it's the same argument for shoes. The difference between humans is smaller than the difference we'll find in our skin suits, our wheels, and our bike setups, and our time trial frames and aerodynamics. And we'll go and win all the medals at the Olympic Games, which they duly did.
I can see the Corans listening to this going, are you telling me we should go back to the old days of steel frames?
Barefoot running. Oh, yeah, I mean, every time. Every time, Tim Hutchins, what do you want, Tim? You want them to run barefoot? No.
Yeah.
Same story.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, it does fly in the face of what we talked about in terms of the performance advantage of running shoes.
Yes.
And this kind of debate does flow into cycling, but there is a purity about cycling, which I've always enjoyed. And I think to some extent, the UCI's attitude towards technology has been pretty good for the road. Maybe it is a bit dodgy, well, questionable.
Some of it's ridiculed, like the sock length thing and
that
sort of stuff. But it is interesting. Cycling is a technologically advanced sport that has somehow remained more pure than running is, which is not a technologically advanced sport.
Yeah.
It goes to show you different contexts.
So news on the rugby and rugby NFL side, and we've here in South Africa, this is an interesting one. So Lewis Rees-Lambert?
Rees-Lambert,
that's right.
Zammett,
He's gone from rugby to, well, is going from rugby to NFL. And we saw this in South Africa 20, 30 years ago with our own South African champion, Nas Buerta, who went to the NFL having just gone there as a kicker.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure how long it lasted, but it wasn't very long. But
he went to the Cowboys, if memory serves me. It was before my time, but he tried out for the Cowboys kicker job. Didn't get it.
Did he not get it?
He didn't play.
Yeah.
He didn't play.
Didn't he? Okay.
No.
I thought he actually played a couple of games.
Maybe in the practice squad or something. I'm not sure. It was before my time. But so this is interesting. The NFL has got this international feeder program where they literally go and find players from outside the United States because, as you can imagine, the sport is almost entirely US-based. Although this, plus their moves to play more games in London, Germany, this year, they'll be playing a game in Brazil, which is really interesting. When I was in New York for a meeting with the NFL, the guys told us that they've got literally like in the millions of people follow them in Brazil. It's like one of their biggest, it's the second biggest market of followers. So they're going to take a game to Brazil, which is really interesting. So they're obviously trying to globalize. And so if you're listening to this from the UK and Wales in particular, Rees-Lambert is leaving you. And if you're listening to this United States, there's a guy on his way to you called Lewis Rees-Lambert. And for those who don't know, Zammett is a Welsh winger, played for Wales, played for the British and Irish Lions as well in the tour they came here. He's one of the bright, young, up-and-coming stars, like known for speed. And so he's one of rugby's great athletes. And so that's why this is causing interest, is because there have been players who've made this attempt before, but I don't think players of the caliber of Rhys Samet have tried to go into the NFL. And so he now joins the class of 2024. They published the names literally this morning, as it is. Who else is going to go for it? There's one other rugby player. And then there's a bunch of guys, Dominican Republic, Nigeria, a bunch of Aussies, a bunch of folk from Australia, New Zealand rather, sorry. So, yeah, it's interesting. And what's interesting about this is like, well, what is his chance of success? Like, how well does talent and ability in rugby translate into another contact sport in which, at surface level, carry the ball, evade players, be tackled or make tackles, it's the same set skill set, but they are such different sports.
I was going to say that.
It's really interesting to look at. Now, kickers, kicking is probably the one where you've got the most chance. And in fact, Henry Malander is another name, a rugby player who's in the same group as Rhys Samet on this international program. He's going as a kicker. Like, and there's an Australian punter kicker in the NFL whose name I now don't know, of course, usually, as usual. And he's achieved great success, plays in the NFL. So that's one example of a guy that was identified in the AFL and has now made the transition across. But I mean, even just kicking. In rugby, you put the ball down on a tee, you've got 60 seconds, you can retreat back to the back of your run-up, you can look up at the poles 4 times, you can scratch each shoulder 10 times, you can do the Macarena like some kickers basically do, and then kick it. Mm. An NFL kicker has to kick a ball in a moving dynamic situation, reliant on the snap, the timing, the placement. It's a very different game, right? Mm. The ball carrying positions and the tackling positions, whole new level of complexity. And so the biggest challenge for Rhys Samet is, can he learn the patterns of play, the playbooks, thousands of plays, not even exaggerating, like literally thousands of possible plays that you can run.
Yeah.
You have to make reads of what the defense is doing. If you're a wide, so Samet, by the way, is going as a running back / wide receiver. Can you make those reads? Can you find space? Once you've got the ball, your evasion skills are different because you're allowed to tackle differently in the NFL. Guys can just dive in head first at your knees.
Yeah.
In rugby, you don't have to worry about that situation. So you know what's coming. So yeah, it's going to be real interesting to see. But I think the broader thing is, you know, for instance, is someone like Samet, who's really good at rugby, potentially disadvantaged by his rugby pattern knowledge compared to someone who's never played rugby but also hasn't played NFL and has nothing to unlearn before they learn the new stuff? You know what I mean?
Mm.
Interesting to wonder about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then does he have the athletic ability? Probably. He'd be in the batch. I mean, there are some freakish athletes in the NFL, you can imagine.
Yeah.
Some of what you get in that particular sport. And Samet might be in the top 2-5% athletically in rugby union. He's probably not in the top 10% in the NFL, but he'll still be good enough if he can learn the game. So it'll be real interesting. My only hope
is there more money in NFL than rugby, do you think?
If you make it, yes.
If you make it.
If you make it. Yeah. I would imagine a superstar in the NFL, in rugby union, is making more than the median NFL.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are average rugby union, average NFL, way more. I mean, I think I saw stats actually, median in the NFL is $830,000 a year.
Sure.
Which is like right at the top end of rugby. Mm. So superstar rugby, NFL, average. Yeah.
So he's probably trying it out because he fancies making himself a bit more
money. Yeah, and he's spoken about it. He said it's just a dream of his to go. And like, it's cool. Like, I think it's great. He's 22, 23, I think, this year.
Mm.
So, you know, if it doesn't work out, you come back to rugby union at 25. He's still got a 10-year career in that sport. But it's my only hope, and I was saying this, there was some lively discussion on the patron message board, is that whatever happens, whether he succeeds or fails, like, there's a all access documentary that explains why. Not from his point of view, but from the NFL's point of view.
Yeah.
I want to know how the NFL evaluate the guy.
Mm.
I don't want his side of it. I want to hear from the coaches and the strength and conditioning guys. I want them to, because I presume they'll put him through tests. I want to know what tests they do and how they interpret that. So, okay, he doesn't have the agility. He's really agile in rugby union. Not for us. Mm. Thanks. That would be
cool.
That'd
be interesting.
And if he succeeds, I want to know why he succeeds. So regardless of success or failure, really want to know. Like, and I'm sure the NFL do this kind of stuff, but it'd be pretty cool to see that story get told, I think.
Yeah. Well, one thing you might have to deal with is that the other day the NFL had the coldest.
Yes.
It was the coldest ever game in history there.
It was in the top five coldest. I think it was the coldest. They had something called the Ice Bowl. Like they call it the Ice Bowl, like many years ago now in Green Bay. I think it was Green Bay, where it was absolutely frigid. But this wasn't that far off with wind chill.
Yeah, what is it? -33?
That's Celsius with wind chill. So at kickoff, Kansas City Chiefs against the Miami Dolphins in the wild card round. Played in the Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City's home stadium.
Many people there.
Yeah, and in shorts and T-shirts. And it's unbelievable. The players come out wearing short sleeve shirts.
Okay.
Which I can't believe. Like, so
maybe the stadium's warmer than the inside of the stadium. Yeah. Was those temperatures, do you know, taken inside the stadium, or were they ambient temperatures outside?
I don't know. And I mean, for sure, like on the sidelines where the teams sit, they've got giant heaters.
Yeah.
That's the only way you can do that. Like, there's no ways. And NFL is probably one of the only sports where you could do it because, in theory, a player, and this was happening, like a guy would go on for a play, make a catch, Travis Kelce, bang, 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 play, come off, miss the next play or two, standing at the side with a big blanket over him, probably getting reheated passively, and then back on the field again. But for guys like the quarterbacks and the lines, they're not getting those breaks. And so they're out there for 5-6 minutes making a long touchdown drive. That's a tough ask. And yeah, but a lot of them were playing in short-sleeved shirts, which was quite remarkable to me. I can't believe that they don't have warmer materials. But yeah, it was -4 Fahrenheit at kickoff, which is 20 degrees below Celsius without wind chill.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievably cold. It was it's incredible.
I mean, what potentially happens at that level? I mean, are you more likely to have injury? I can imagine it must be quite difficult to play the game just by not being able to stay warm because your muscles need to be warm.
Yeah, so muscular skeletal tendon injuries for sure, because few things are happening. Obviously, the muscle itself is getting colder. As long as you can stop that. If you stay warm in those temperatures, if you're running and exercising, you'll stay warm enough. But if you allow your skin temperature and consequently muscle temperature to drop, then you're at risk of injury. You're also at risk of underperformance, which is the first thing that happens. In fact, there's quite good evidence that if you cool the skin, the muscle gets weaker, which is quite interesting. So muscle force production drops at skin temperatures as skin temperature goes down. So keeping the skin warm is as important as keeping the muscle warm for performance. Then the other thing is your nerve conduction velocity drops. And so your ability to sense and feel things is going to be impaired. Plus you get, eventually it leads to what we recognize as numbness. But, you know, cold water swimmers really struggle because their fingers start to crimp and so on, and their muscles get shorter, their elbows flex. They get considerably weaker and less efficient. Now, playing on a cold, dry day, at least you don't have to worry about that water factor, but you still have to worry about the fact. So catching a ball, executing fine motor skills would be much more difficult in cold conditions than in warm conditions, which is why teams change the way they play. They tend not to pass as much because they understand that wide receivers are just not going to be as effective as normal. So you see more run plays and so on. Then another interesting thing is a study came out last year showing that concussion risk is higher in the cold, which is interesting. And the study didn't explore why that might be, because the first obvious thing is, oh yeah, the ground gets harder, and so you hit your head on the ground. But like this Kansas City Stadium, Arrowhead, has got these, they showed it in the broadcast, they've got these massive boilers under the field that keep the ground temperature the same. So that actually would make a big difference to this, the cold sensation on the field, because the ground is actually like warmed up, maybe not to the 20 degrees Celsius would be on a normal day, but it's not, the ground is not negative 20 degrees Celsius, it's 2 degrees, whatever, it's not, you know, it's not frozen. But the more interesting point there is that not many, certainly in rugby, not many concussions happen on the ground, head ground. In the NFL it's more, particularly the quarterback, when they get tackled backwards, they often, because now you can't get your arms out behind you, and they get tackled going backwards, and then they hit their heads on the turf behind them. So that is a potential mechanism for more concussion in cold weather. I have a feeling it might be related to
that. I'm not sure I understand that correctly. So I'm still not sure what factor the cold plays in that.
So the theory is that the ground is harder.
And
so when you fall backwards and you hit your head on the ground, you're hitting your head on concrete as opposed to soft grass.
Because equivalent the grass,
which does make sense. But in the NFL, yes, there are more, particularly the quarterback is more at risk of a backward impact on the back of their heads because they're tackled backwards. It doesn't happen much in rugby, actually. Very small proportion of rugby's concussions are from the ground. Yeah, so that's the one theory. The other theory would be that the way they change the plays and the potential reaction time of players, maybe everything's a little bit slower and subdued in the cold because of this, what I was mentioning earlier. The forces might be down because of cold skins. Maybe that's why the concussion risk is different. I don't know. Like, it's your ability to, who knows? They didn't explore it, so it's hard to tell. But
my sports scientist brain is working here and going, there must be some other reason why this could happen because it doesn't.
It doesn't add up to me.
There's definitely something more to that. It could be maybe you are more susceptible to concussions when you're colder. I mean,
could be some intrinsic thing to do with vascular compliance, like blood flow and so on in the brain.
Colder blood vessels are obviously not as expanded.
Could well be.
And your blood pressure is probably a bit lower. And actually, it'd be higher, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If your blood vessels are constricted, their blood pressure
would be higher. Which could be the thing. I mean, remember, there was that. So I call it a scam. We interviewed a guy, James Maliga, last year on the pod, like about this theory that woodpeckers use their tongue to compress their jugular vein, and that increases the pressure in their heads, and that's why woodpeckers don't get concussed. So anyway, that's right.
Yes, we actually had a podcast exactly on that.
It turns out that woodpeckers don't actually do that. So even the theory was false, but James Maliga explained why even that wouldn't make a difference to concussion risk. So that's not what it is. But there could well be something else in the vascular. I don't know. I mean, I'm nobody's idea of a neurologist, and I'm not going to pretend to be, unlike some neurologists.
That would be interesting from a world rugby perspective, because if you're playing the game in the European winter,
yes,
and there is a factor, is there a chance of more concussions in winter than there is in summer?
So this study that found, among other things, cold temperatures increase the risk of concussion, came out just at the start of Rugby World Cup. And you might recall that the first 3 weeks of the Rugby World Cup were really hot in France.
Yeah.
We used to take water breaks every 20 minutes in the game. Yeah. And we also saw very few concussions in those first 3 weeks of the Rugby World Cup. And I jokingly said, well, here's the solution. We just have to play rugby in the summer and we'll have fewer concussions. I think I'm not actually suggesting that, but it's certainly, now that South Africa's playing in the URC, and we have matches in that competition during our December, January, February. Like this weekend, there are some games where French teams, English teams are out here. Within the next 3 or 4 years, we should look to answer this, whether games played in South Africa's summer are less likely to cause concussions than games played in South Africa's winter and vice versa for the North. Who knows? Maybe there's something there.
There is potentially a hypothesis there.
For sure. Like the finding from that Smaliga paper last year showing more concussions in cold temperatures sets up a hypothesis that would be useful to explore. I'm just not yet persuaded that it's a real finding.
I was going to say, maybe changing the seasonality of rugby would be a significant change.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And the thing about it is, like, in the NFL, the colder matches are the back end of the season. So maybe you're seeing... an increased risk of concussion because of time in the season, and it just happens to coincide with cooler temperatures. I don't know. Like, you got to correct for lots of different things, right?
I was going to say that's your next. That's your next 2 years of research.
Just in this conversation, we've come up with three possible confounding factors. You see, this stuff's not simple.
It's not simple.
Yeah.
Well, that's why it's your job at World Rugby.
Lucky me.
So another confounding bit of news is the world champion, Olympic and world champion in the triathlon, Christian Blumenfeld. So he did a test recently where his numbers were shown to be having a VO2 max of over 100, which is, I mean, let's putting that into context, most elite athletes will be between sort of probably above 80, late 70s, sort of thing. But over 100, I mean, there was... a lot of raised eyebrows about that. Did you see that? Did you see any of the numbers?
And then I watched, because a few people on Patreon had actually said you've got to watch the series. It's a series being made called The Norwegian Method.
Yeah.
You know, like Norway now, it's got obviously the Ingebrigtsens, and it's got a really strong triathlon program. And there's been a lot of discussion around this Norwegian Method, which includes, among other things, like double sessions at lactate threshold. So they're doing these trainings. So they have this episode where they film this guy on a treadmill. Turns out it's Carsten Blumenfeld, right? And he maxes out, and then they do this cut to the screen, and you can see the VO2 and some of the other measures, the ventilation, minute ventilation, which is liters of air breathed per minute.
And what was the number then on the VO2?
The VO2,
what are they claiming?
was like 7.7 liters per minute, and at his mass was 100. It gives a VO2 max of 102 mils per kilogram.
Because he's quite a biggish fella.
Yes, in the mid 70 kilogram range.
Yeah, so he's not quite a tiny, stocky. Stocky guy.
So 7.7 liters per minute of oxygen, 102 mils per kilogram per minute, which is the figure that raised eyebrows.
Okay.
And minute ventilation, which is the first sign that something's not quite right, was 247 liters per minute. So that means he's breathing in 247.
Now, what's a normalish, right there?
So,
give me some context
some
on
people,
that one.
Some people posted this, tagged me and some other people. Trent Stellingworth was one of those people who then got involved on Twitter. And Trent says, 247 liters per minute. We have data on Olympic gold medal rowers who weigh 100 plus kilograms who don't hit this or don't even get close to that. So 200 liters per minute is considered exceptionally high for a big guy.
Mm.
247 for 75 suggests that maybe you want to look at your equipment.
There might be some calibration issues.
Then the other thing that I think was even more telling is when you do these tests, you measure... Obviously, you're measuring air in and out. So oxygen in, consumed, carbon dioxide out. That ratio, carbon dioxide exhaled to oxygen in, is called the respiratory quotient or exchange ratio. And when it's 0.7, it's got physiological meaning. When that ratio is 0.7, it means you're oxidizing fats, no carbs. So if your energy is coming exclusively from fat oxidation, you breathe out 0.7 liters of carbs, carbon dioxide, for every 1 liter of oxygen. That makes sense?
Oh, wow.
0.7.
Okay. So you're saying the gases that you breathe out are indicative of the fuel you're using.
Yes. Okay. It's interesting.
I never knew that.
As you go up in intensity and you start to use more and more carbon dioxide and CO2.
Carbs.
I just got double confused in explaining my confusion. As your exercise intensity goes up, your reliance on carbohydrates goes up. And then what happens is, relatively, your carbon dioxide exhalation goes up as well. So that ratio rises. And at about 0.85, it's 50-50. So if you ever do a gas test and your respiratory quotient or REO is 0.85, you're getting half your energy from carbohydrates and half from fats. And then as you get a little bit faster, it goes up even more. And so eventually you get 0.9, 0.95. And then you get to 1, which is where all your energy, in theory, is coming from carbohydrates. Because you're burning glucose now, and every molecule of glucose gives you 1 gram of carbon dioxide. Every 1 gram of glucose gives you 1 carbon dioxide and 1 VO2. In, out. Makes sense, right?
Right. Yeah.
Because you can look at the equation for oxidizing glucose, and you'll see that it takes 1 oxygen for every 1 carbon dioxide. 1 to 1.
Oh, wow. Okay. And just for clarity, when we talk about those, it's obviously your carbohydrates are your fast burning fuels. Therefore, the higher the effort, the body then moves into a space where it uses faster burning fuels. Okay.
So by the time you get to the end of a max test, you should be well over 1, because then what happens is you get to the point where it's carbs now, fat oxidation is really low, it's suppressed, and then you start to actually liberate carbon dioxide from your body's pools because you become... okay, I hate the word, but anaerobic. Let's say oxygen independent. And so now you start producing excess lactate and the acidosis. And now you get, it's a biochemical reaction that takes place. Now all of a sudden your carbon dioxide outstrips your oxygen. So now that ratio, carbon dioxide divided by oxygen, goes above 1. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when you read the protocols of max tests, often they say a true max test was inferred because the RQ was above 1.1. In other words, in many labs, if you don't get to 1.1, they don't consider it to be a true max.
Right. Okay.
When the cameras pan...
Which means that you're not able to bring enough oxygen to fuel the work.
Yeah. At this
point,
therefore,
you become reliant on other fuel sources beyond...
Yeah, beyond normal glucose. And so now you're producing lactate at increasing rates. Yeah. And so that CO2 level goes up even beyond the normal ratio of burning only carbs. Now it's indicative that... you're liberating carbon dioxide from the body's carbon dioxide pool, the bicarbonate pool. Does that make sense,
more or less?
Yeah. So when the camera pans to Blumenfeld's the screen just after his VO2 max, his RQ is 0.94.
He's not flat out, yeah.
Yeah. So Trent Stellingworth says, it says that REO is only 0.94 for a maximum effort. this low RER suggests that VO2 is being overreported here, which is what I think is the case, because he's exhaling all this carbon dioxide and he's consuming all this oxygen, but that ratio should be way above one. But something is driving the VO2, to, in my opinion, and I agree with Trent, to be too high. And as a consequence, you're overestimating VO2 max and underreporting what the RER is.
Okay.
So I don't consider that to be a true, I wouldn't consider that to be a true value.
Yeah. I mean, can you remember offhand what the highest VO2 max that you've actually ever seen?
Me, personally, mid-70s, but I've never tested. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, like a lot of elite cyclists are in the mid-70s. And one of the reasons for it is, and runners, it's the same. We tested a bunch of elite Kenyan half marathon 10K guys, average 10K time 28, half marathon 61. Mm-hmm. None of them was above 75.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, because what they all have, and which paradoxically or actually logically, if you think about it, reduces VO2 max is exceptional economy. So they are Priuses, they're hybrid cars, they're Toyota, that not Toyota Prius, they're Teslas, you know, as opposed to Ford Mustangs or Formula One cars, you know that? So, and this is the point, is that when you are exceptionally economical or efficient, you don't use as much oxygen. So your VO2 max is lower. That's what happens. So there's actually, and it's been published, Lucia et al., there's an inverse relationship between VO2 max and cycling efficiency in elite cyclists.
Right.
Cyclists who have exceptionally high VO2 max tend to have very relatively low efficiency and vice versa. So when you see a cyclist with a low VO2 max, that doesn't mean he's rubbish. It just means that he might be low because he's got something else that makes him exceptional.
Sure.
Okay. Right?
Because that flies in the face of what people have been told for years, that VO2 max was a real indicator of performance.
And I think we're part
seeing
of it,
that change now.
Yeah, and I think part of it, and it's a sort of a segue into where we're going to go with this, is in the beginning, VO2 max is what you could measure. So it became all important. And then you realize, actually, we can measure a few other things. Maybe they're as important. And so running economy or cycling efficiency became important. In fact, a guy called Alan Cousins made a comment on the Blumenfeld results saying that if you can get to a VO2 max at 102 at the speeds that he's running at, your running economy must be, okay, and I'll try and contextualize, 250 mils per kilogram per kilometer. So every kilometer you run, you are using 250 mils of oxygen per kilogram. That is rubbish. It's so bad that like an elite athlete could not conceivably have that poor an economy.
Okay.
So that's more evidence that the Blumenfeld numbers just don't add up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the elite Kenyans we tested, economy 180. So that what this is saying is that this Blumenfeld's 40% worse economically than our good Kenyans. Impossible. He might be 10% worse. Sure, I could get that. But not 40. So so again, the implication of Blumenfeld's test is unbelievably bad economy, not a max test because of that RQ, and a massively overestimated ventilation rate. Doesn't add up.
And just to suggest, what does that mean? In other words, there's something wrong with the machinery they're using. It could be a calibration issue.
Yes. And so Trent Stillingworth, and I'm going to post a link to this so you can read it there.
It's a fascinating discussion.
A guy called Baz van Hurren wrote a paper called Accuracy of Respiratory Gas Variables, Substrates and Energies from 15 Different Systems. This was published in 2023, so like late last year. And so basically what they did was they evaluated 15 widely available systems that do this measurement to assess their accuracy. And what they showed is that the error of gas variables, substrate, and energy use differed substantially between systems, with only a few systems generating a consistent acceptable error. We extensively discussed the implications. That's not a great finding.
Sure. Okay.
That means that what exercise physiology labs in the world are using are neither comparable to one another, nor might they be reliable.
Sure.
And then
how do you establish a baseline
exactly
for that anyway?
Exactly.
Who has got the most accurate, and how do you measure that?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's
2023, right? September 2023, that paper comes out.
Sure.
So how many years and decades worth of shitty data might there be?
Well, I remember very particularly hearing, and I don't know why this always sticks in my head, but I remember back in the day when William Toller, the South African who won the New York Marathon in 1992, he had a claimed VO2 max of 84. I don't know why that always stays in my head, but again, That was a long time ago. Mm. And you can imagine that the reliability of that equipment there was vastly different from what it is now.
Yeah, I mean, like there used to be this method called Douglas bags, where basically these massive balloon looking bags,
and yes,
used
to
breathe in and out of those. That's still considered the gold standard.
Mm.
They are reliable because you literally just capture the air in a bag and then you analyze its carbon dioxide and oxygen content later.
Mm.
And you'd go through a test like this. In the early days, A.V. Hill, there was a famous video or photo I've seen of him sort of sitting on the back of a car strapped to a device, and the runner had this tube, and like they're swapping Douglas bags out every few minutes as they go through this incremental test. Now you got this tech that supposedly makes it all simpler, but maybe doesn't reach the same standards that it should. So yeah, so that's the situation. And Trent Crost on Twitter, later in the video, I see the use of a VO2 master device, which unfortunately did not show up well in this data from Baz Van Hur, and makes me question other data too. So there's questions around this, and it's an interesting catalyst to a conversation about actually the meaning of exercise physiology testing.
Yeah.
If a performance is determined by differences of 2-4%, which is overstating the truth, it's probably less, and the device that predicts performance is off by 6-8%, does the device have any meaning?
Yeah.
Not really.
I guess also a big question is, do the stats have any meaning at all anyway, and why are they relevant?
Like, yeah, because it's so complex. Because you can have a guy with a VO2 max of 85 get beaten by a guy with a VO2 max of 74, because the 74 guy is unbelievably efficient on the bike or economical in the running, plus the ability to sustain threshold. And so it's not VO2 max. It's not VO2 max and running economy and lactate threshold or ability to sustain. There's probably loads of different things, and and one of them is this next subject. But yeah, that's the point. Yeah. Is
I mean, not to give away some of the information in the podcast that's coming out. Our next podcast, in fact, where we interviewed a very well known elite level mountain biker who talked about the fact that when he goes riding, he knows how unreliable different power meters are, and therefore he only relates his performance to what that power meter says.
His own one.
So he can't go and ride somebody else's bike or go into a lab and say, well, he just works on what he knows.
Yeah.
And he doesn't compare his numbers to other people because his power meter might give a different reading. So it's
correct.
It's interesting. It shows you how unscientific science can be.
Yeah. And we trust blindly that the newest tech must be the best, but sometimes, it's
not. I know there's always this tenet, and I'm sure you'll confirm this, is that when they teach you at sports science, question everything is the key tenet. You have to question everything.
Well,
is that really what you have to do?
I remember way back when, one of the coolest things I ever did was I gave a presentation at the Royal Society in London, which is the famous scientific institution. And Darwin, for instance, when he came back from his voyage around the world in the HMS Beagle, presented at the Royal Society to them his theories of evolution. And I was there. I was invited to give a talk there once. And you walk up the staircase with this grand sort of stained glass window, and their motto and coat of arms is there. And the motto is Nullius in Verbia, which basically means on nobody's word. Which is to say, take no one's word for it. And so that's what scientists should be doing.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool to see that stained glass window. Yeah.
So for those of you youngsters who are studying sports science, it's probably a good thing to remember as you go through your careers.
Yeah, take nobody's word for it.
So we have touched very briefly on the idea of how we measure performance now. And one of the things that's caught my eye on the various social media channels is this idea about durability. So there's some discussion, and we have touched on this a bit last year, but it's worth just mentioning because they're saying that in 2024, the measure of performance is going to be durability as opposed to anything else. You know, VO2 max and that kind of thing's fallen away. And there are questions about what that durability means. Is it not just a case of more stamina?
It's sort of. I don't want to start us off on semantics that lose people, but I think there is an important distinction between semantics and between stamina and durability. Durability is a type of stamina. It's a context-specific stamina. So let's first of all say, what do you mean by stamina?
Well, the ability to be able to go longer, harder for longer.
Okay, so ability to withstand and resist fatigue.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Fatigue resistance. And in fact, in some of the articles, you'll often see fatigue resistance. And I always pull up on that wording, fatigue resistance, because let's say I ask you to do a 10-minute max effort. It's the Constantia neck climb for us in Cape Town, or it's Red Hill or whatever, 12 minutes, whatever that is. fatigue resistance is in play there, because what I'm asking you to do is to go at 320 watts for 10 minutes. Can you do it? Or do you get to 8 minutes and then you start to drop off to below 300 watts? That shows me that your stamina or your fatigue resistance is not where it needs to be. We need to develop it. Mm-hmm. So within a task, fatigue resistance is the ability to sustain a certain power output without succumbing to fatigue.
Yeah.
What durability is saying is the same task either side of a fatiguing bout. So now, instead of a 10-minute bout where my challenge to you is 320 watts, it's to say, let's do a 10-minute bout, then 2 hours of riding, and then do a 10-minute bout and compare the power in those two 10-minute bouts. So it's a slightly different thing. It is still fatigue resistance, but it's in a different context. Does that make sense? In
other words, it's the ability to recover better?
Yeah, it's the ability to withstand the accumulated effect of fatigue and then produce as close to your best as possible, despite the fact that you've accumulated considerable amounts of fatigue over the course of the ride.
So in my head, I'm thinking about when we watch the top Tour de France riders racing up a climb,
there'll
be an attack, but their ability to be able to attack and recover and keep going at a higher level is durability.
Is fatigue resistance.
Is fatigue resistance.
And it could be durability because, okay, Alpe d'Huez is maybe a little bit on the long side. It's a 7K, 8K climb, 20-minute effort for those guys at 6 watts, 6.5 watts a kilo at the end of a Tour de France stage where they've been in the saddle for 4.5 hours and then have to do 20 minutes at 6.5. If those same guys had done that same effort fresh, they would have been at 6.7 watts a kilo, only very slightly better than when they're fatigued.
Right.
That's durability.
Right.
How closely can I replicate my best after a fatiguing bout? Whereas the strict classic definition of fatigue resistance is how closely can I sustain a power output within a given power? They're very similar things, yes. But just the context is important because when we talk about durability, we're saying is how much does time in the saddle hurt you? That's what it is.
Yes.
And what's interesting like this, and we discussed it in a pod last year. There's some data that's come out that the under 23 guy and the elite pro tour guy can produce the same power for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes when they're fresh. The difference is that the pro guy, the pro tour, the Tour de France viable candidate is able to get really close to that fresh power even after 2.5, 3 hours of riding. That under 23 guy or the less quality, the poorer, I don't want to use that word, it sounds, they're still amazing cyclists, they drop off more as a consequence of time in the saddle.
Yeah,
does
it makes sense.
Make sense?
It does make sense. And I think to some extent, I've just always tried to bring it back to, and I'm sure many of you who do endurance sport will kind of learn to understand that. It's the ability to be able to go out, particularly on a, for instance, we have a ride that we do every Wednesday called the Wednesday Whip. And I always think it's an interesting indicator of the whip part of that ride is a very fast segment where everybody races flat out. By the end of that segment, I always feel slightly nauseous as if I'm going to bring up some bile. But my ability to be able to recover and keep going at the pace that we were maintaining before that ride has become significantly shorter as I've got fitter. So I'm trying to relate that to my own, but it sounds like it's about that. So for the top performers, they don't want to have a hard effort and just die. They want to have a half effort and still be able to maintain and stay with
and repeat that. So it's your ability to repeat or to get as close to your fresh max as possible despite accumulated work. So for the whip, for instance, it's about a 700 meter long sort of sprint we do. It takes about a minute.
Trying to be pro athlete.
It takes a minute to a minute and 20 depending on the wind direction here in Cape Town, because it's either straight into or straight with the wind. So it's a highly variable segment. Okay, and the whip is like 35 minutes into the ride, so it's probably not far enough in. But what want to be asking in terms of durability is, right, I know that my mate Craig, who wins the whip, can do 620 watts for that minute. And that's what he's going to do to beat me, okay? But if I make the pace for the first 35 minutes really hard, then let's see if he can do 620 watts, or will he drop to 550?
Yeah.
And is that my chance to beat the guy? So in other words, I'm going to preload Craig with fatigue and then hope that my chances are better because my durability is better than his.
Yes.
So when we see, so again, Tour de France, Jonas Vingegaard in those Alpine stages when he wins the tour, the last two tours, has been the same model. Is we're going to make the stage really, really hard. And then by the time we get to the second last year or 2 years ago, the last climb, Pogacar won't be able to produce what Pogacar normally does. Now, that might be heat. It might be pre-fatigue from days before. But it's the same concept. Is Vingegaard is placing a bet that he can compromise Pogacar more by loading him before the decisive climb than himself. Yeah?
Yes.
In a fresh race, I reckon they are very close together. But in a fatigued state, that's where the difference is going to be made. And that's for various reasons in this particular context, right? So, and similar, to win Flanders, Pogacar knows that he's going to need 2 minutes on the Quaremont and 53 seconds on Paterberg at a certain wattage. But Van der Poel can also do that wattage. So therefore, Pogacar says, well, I'm going to not let you do that fresh. I'm going to hurt you over the course of the 30 Ks before that decisive climb, and then my durability will be the difference between us.
Mm.
Because I can do in a fatigued state closer to my best than you can do in your fatigued state.
Yeah.
And that's how I'm going to win.
So it sounds like, I mean, the quote from the performance coordinator of the UAE Team Emirates, which is one of our South African doctors who literally just is just down the road from where we are now, Jeroen Swart, saying the big thing in training science at the moment is durability. It's a hot topic in research circles and in terms of performance implementation, because there's a couple of questions. First of all, how do you measure it?
Mm.
And then I guess the second question, if you can measure it, then how do you train for it?
Yes. So the measurement part is easier, at least on the surface, because the definition of durability is how much do you drop off a level of effort when you are loaded with fatigue. So it's easy. You do the effort without fatigue, and then you do the effort after fatigue, and you just compare them. And you say, my 5 minute best in a fresh state is 300 watts. My 5 minute best when I'm fatigued is 250 watts. Therefore, I've dropped off by 17%. My durability is 83. Not very good.
Right.
Now, improving it's another story, but that's how you measure it. So,
right.
And whether that's a 1 minute effort, a 5 minutes, a 10, you can decide depending on the context of what you're preparing for. If you are going to do a race and you know that it's going to take a 10 minute effort, that's the durability component you'd want to work on. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually real basic. Like you could do this on our Friday ride. If you jumped on your trainer and you measured your power output for a 3 minute max effort before we go, then we go do our normal ride, normal speed, come back, do the 3 minute again. Durability is just the drop-off.
Mm.
Well, the inverse. Yeah. One minus the drop-off. Makes sense, yeah?
Yeah. Okay.
Now, the thing about it is where it gets a little nuanced is what should the fatiguing bout be? Like, so in the study, for instance, it was 2.5 hours at, say, 60% of peak power or half of 50% of lactate threshold or whatever the case is. So that dose of fatigue has to be standardized, because if I do a 5 minute effort at home and then I go ride 2 hours hard or 2 hours easy, I'm going to get quite a different durability outcome when I do my 5 minute post. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd want to standardize. So ideally you'd want to do the whole thing on an indoor trainer. You want to do a 5 minute effort, then 2 hours at 150 watts and then a 5 minute effort.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference? How much did I lose because of loading fatigue on myself? Mm-hmm. That's durability.
Swimming actually does this quite well, because in swimming, I used to do a lot of master swimming, and we used to do sets where you would do 100 meters on 130, 1 minute 30. And what you would do is you would do 10 times 100 on 130, and then you'd come in at about 120, and then you'd have 10 seconds to rest.
Okay,
and then
again,
the key marker on that and the key message from the coaches in that situation is try and keep your 100 meters exactly the same. In other words, you should be able to swim hard, have that 10-second rest, and swim hard again and again and again, 10 times. And that was the key marker for those sets. Not to go super hard, 115s, then run 25s at the end.
128s, you're just barely turning before you've got to be touching.
So you want to have that durability to be able to maintain a high pace for a long time. So it was, that's a good,
Again, I would say that's more on the fatigue resistance side. Durability is a component of it, where you sandwich a fatiguing bout either side of a test, and the comparison of the test pre-post,
there's a nuanced
difference
there,
slight difference, but I think quite an important one. Now, as to how you train it, I suspect it's not trained any differently to fatigue resistance. What you spoke earlier about the whip, where we do that effort, then it's a hard 700 meters, then often, like, there's a few little short rolly climbs, people go hard at different times and so on, and then you can do that last climb at the end. Well, I'd be looking at durability and saying, like, Can I do that last climb as close as possible to my max? That's durability.
Yeah.
Training that means repeating the stimulus and the stress of like overlaying the demand to do high intensity work off the back of preloaded fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you would have to train that. But you'd also train that by saying we want the stress of the, in a pro tour, the 4 hours before the final climb. We need that to not be as stressful. Like, that's not really training durability per se, but it's going to make you more look more durable is if the loaded fatigue doesn't affect you as much because it's not as large. That's the same dose doesn't cause the same fatigue. That's the other way to do it. So you could do it in two ways, I think.
And it sounds like it's the sort of idea behind it is very specific to cycling, because in every other endurance event, whether it's triathlon, maybe triathlon to some extent, but particularly the Olympic distance, most of the time it's almost like a time trial effort. So it's about maintaining a high speed and wattage for a long period of time.
Sure. Running is a little different, maybe,
You do surge a bit, I suppose, in running, but not to the same extent as you do in cycling.
I'll offer you one example of where people often get this wrong: is if you're watching the last 5K of a marathon, and it's two guys or women racing each other, and one of them's from a track background and the other's not. The commentators will always say the athlete with a track background has the speed, and therefore they're the favorite to win this race. They don't consider the fact that there's 37 Ks that have been run, and that those 37 Ks may blunt the speed of that one athlete with a track background.
But then again, it rarely happens. The track athlete normally
athletes normally like got great pedigree, like it's Helen Abiri or it's Sifan Hassan. Like, doesn't matter how you run the race, she's beating you.
Right. Okay.
Like, but you do see it sometimes though. So, like, if Mo Farah, for instance, just didn't have the durability to convert his track pedigree into a good marathon. So, Mo Farah against any of the athletes who were running against him at the time, Kipsang or whatever, for instance, in a 1.5, in a 5,000 or a 10,000, he's beating them. But if he's with them with 10K to go in a marathon, I know who my money's on. Because Kipsang's ability to run as close to his 10K best at the end of a marathon is way better than what Farah ever managed to develop. And so that's a durability difference maker.
That's a very good example, actually.
For runners, I would say the same thing is true. You're right, the range of speed and acceleration differences is nowhere near as large in running. We're talking a shift from 258 to 253 is winning the race. In cycling, it's from 350 watts to 800. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
But it's the same concept in running, is that you can put two athletes with 2Ks to go, and you can say, oh, the one who's got the fastest 2K is winning. No, they're not. The one who's got the ability to run a fast 2K off the back of a 40K fatigue load, that's the athlete who's winning. That's the key.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. That's a good way of getting it. I hope you all understand that. I think I understand it a lot better from my initial reading of that article. So, yeah, it is an interesting space. Anyway, that's us for today.
We didn't even get to do New Year's resolutions.
Well, we can talk very briefly about New Year's resolutions. What are your New Year's resolutions podcast?
I've chosen mine as introductions to topics we're going to cover this year. So number one is lift more weights.
Right.
Because there's been quite a good discussion on Patreon, actually, in response to my latest post, in which I linked to an article talking about the health benefits of resistance training, which I think have always been known, but have now been expanded, because it used to be lean muscle mass and strength, you do resistance, cardiovascular health, you do endurance, cardio type training. The crossover between those two types is considerably larger than was ever thought and understood and recognized and respected.
Yes.
And so therefore resistance training has benefits way more than just get strong, get toned. So more resistance training. And we want to cover that, so I will get Stuart Phillips and other experts on the pod to try and unpack and explain how you go about doing it.
Because that, again, is complex and how you really do that.
And the problem in that space is even more than endurance, is that there's just so many people trying to sell you something.
Yeah.
Like the number of charlatans in resistance training is probably double that in the endurance space. So we got to do a bit of scientific education around lifting weights. Like, do you lift heavy or light? High reps, low, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Then my second one is to eat more Cocoa Pops.
Okay. So, you better give us the context of that.
Context to that is last year we discussed a lot about the shift in endurance sport to say that we are probably historically under-fueled with carbohydrates. Even really, not, and I'm not talking about the low carb movement where the pendulum swung way over to the left. I'm talking even before that, in the professional sport, like the target used to be 60 to 80 grams an hour. It's now 100 to 140 grams an hour. So the requirement for carbohydrates is one of, and fueling with carbs, I think is one of the big things that has changed in sports science in the last 5 or 6 years. And I was listening to a podcast, that again, that Performance Process, hosted by Ronan McLaughlin from Escape Collective. And they interviewed the nutritionist from Bora Hansgrohe. And he said, one of the most common foods that you will see a professional cyclist eating the day of a race or stage in the tour is Cocoa Pops. Why? Because in the immediate short term before they start, what your body needs is just the simplest, fastest, most direct sugar it can possibly get. Mm. And Cocoa Pops is the go-to for those guys. So I said, right, I'm buying Cocoa Pops. And so now I wake up at 5:30 or 6, whatever it is in the morning. I have a bowl of Cocoa Pops with very little milk, because milk is a problem for some people. Mm. And then off I go. And that's my first fueling strategy for the rides. And then I carry, obviously, fuels with me, which I also never used to do. But I'm trying this year to fuel better, to see what it does to my own recovery and performance. So that's why Cocoa Pops is on my New Year's resolution.
And you quoted this the other day when we were riding. Yeah. We were talking about, who was it again that we interviewed, talking about fuel effort. What was the quote? Where you fuel
the... Graham Close.
Graham Close, that's
like
right.
Like three seasons ago or something. Graham Close is a nutritionist, has worked in multiple sports. And he says, the number one rule is fuel for the task at hand.
That's right. That's what you said.
So if you are doing nothing and sitting at a desk, couch, even going shopping, whatever it is, Saturday morning I go to the builder's warehouse, I'm doing DIY, whatever. That's not strenuous. I don't need those Cocoa Pops. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going for a 60K ride... and I'm not going to wake up at 4 in order to eat breakfast 2 hours before I pedal. Mm. I need something in the tank before I go, and then I need something as I go. So I'd need to have something on the bike, in the bottle, in the gel, whatever the case is, before we get to the coffee stop. And yeah, and we really need to. Look, we touched on it so often last year. You said in our last part of 2023 that one of the best pods of the year was the one where we got into this carb stuff. And I know you've tried fueling as well differently. Yeah.
Not to the same extent you have, but over the longer distance, it has made a significant difference.
It definitely does. And I've noticed now that I'm changing from an owl into a lark going these morning rides.
But
if I don't take, even for a short 40K, 1.5 hour ride, if I don't take something in a bottle, I get home at 7:30, 8, and by 10 o'clock, I'm ready to eat a 3-course meal. I'm absolutely ravenous. The bottle keeps the hunger at bay. And so it shows you that, like, your body is asking for fuel. And if you don't give it, there's potential consequences. So I'm trying all of this. The Cocoa Pops, I say, is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but there's a broader fuel strategy. And I think this year we must get some guests on to really explore this a little bit more. It feeds into, I know you've been talking about intermittent fasting. Like, how do you fit that into an active lifestyle, for instance?
That's one of my goals for this year in this podcast, is to kind of get into the weeds of things like that. Because there is so much, you know, disinformation and information, and people have been sending me research articles around fasting. I've tried a bit of it myself. After 2 days, I'm over it, you know, like, it just doesn't seem, but then you speak to a dietitian, and I remember a couple of years ago, a year ago, spending some time with the dietitian, and the strategy made a lot of sense. You know, eat early in the morning, do what you're doing, feel when you need the fuel. Mm. And, you know, I'm just very interested to see what the real experts talk about when they talk about things like fasting diets, because people really believe in that stuff. And I want to know how much of that stuff is really achievable.
Yeah, and I agree. But we have to do it with people who understand exercise. Because I think the person who can get away with fasting relatively easily and who's inactive is not a good case study for the person listening, I hope, to this podcast and us.
Yeah.
Because again, there's quite good evidence that if you underfuel regularly, even through the day, never mind during the bout, that your fatigue, your overtraining is more risky, your risk of illness and injury, your mood states, everything is negatively compromised. So fueling for the task at hand, again, Graham Close credit, is really necessary. And how you then fit that, does that fit with sporadic intermittent fasting when the fuel isn't required for the task at hand, as opposed to the days that it is? You know, you ride Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday morning, those are not fasting days. Maybe Does it work if you only do it half the time? I think there's really interesting questions there.
And people do a lot of fasting rides, don't they?
Yeah, lots of people advise that, and coaches used to. Yeah. But I just have found that I could do that. Yeah, I just can't do that when I'm riding every morning. It's just by Thursday, Friday, I'm just overeating in the afternoons and the evenings to try and make up for what I wasn't fueling myself with. Plus, I'm interested to see, like, if I get that fueling on the bike ride and I can suppress appetite beyond the bike ride, whether that might help with weight loss, for instance. Because, I mean, last year, sat in your office, I said I had my goal was to lose 5 kilograms, and by the end of the year last year, I had 7 to go. I feel like this year I can make the same joke, and I prefer not to. I'd actually like to hit a goal for a change, and not be in the negatives. So, yeah, let's see. That's definitely a topic I want to explore a lot of this year.
Yeah. Anyway, so don't forget, you can send us your suggestions. Tell us what you'd like to hear about and any ideas that you might have for us to be able to investigate and bring in the experts. Because one of the nicest things about what we've done in the last couple of years on this podcast is bring in some of the experts, and not just, you know, the lightweights, the major players in this market who are really able to give us the information that we need. So that's one of the things we're looking forward to having more of this year. The next podcast we've got an exciting guest, and always lovely to have a very top athlete explaining what his life is like as a top athlete. So that's our next podcast that's coming out in just over a week from now, and keep that in mind as well. But we're looking forward to a good 2024, and we're looking forward to having you all involved on our Patreon site. Of course, you can join us on there and be part of the discussion on there. And of course, we're on all of our social media as well. Always lovely to hear from you all.
Plus
an Olympic Games.
Unaffected by COVID. It'll be our first Olympics, not tainted by COVID, we hope.
There we go. So that'll be an exciting, so big year in sport ahead in many different ways. But for now, it's goodbye.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.